Lecture 26, Making the American Language, from Noah Webster to H.L. Mencken.
Hello, and welcome back to These United States. I say United States now because Noah Webster and his contemporaries were writing at a time when America was not just America, not just a loosely confederated collection of former colonies, but truly a United States, and where ideas of union and independence informed notions of language use and language change. The American language, for Noah Webster, is a language uniquely suited to and uniquely expressive of the American experience. In this lecture, I'm going to look at Webster's writing on language and use as a kind of bridge other 19th century American writers to move from Webster to Mencken, bookends, as it were, who define and codify the American language as it has been inherited by us. In looking at Webster also, I want to go back to some of the issues I raised at the close of my last lecture. Webster, as we saw, began his career not really as a lexicographer, but as a pedagogue and a grammarian. His early publications in the 1780s and 90s were grammar books. The Grammatical Institute, published in 1783 and reissued in 1784 and 85, the Dissertations on the English Language, published in 1791, all of these are texts that define the American language as a band of national union. Indeed, I closed my previous lecture with this aphoristic quotation from Webster: "A national language is a band of national union." In effect, the American language binds together, unites the former colonies into a nation. The national language now is the shared form of expression that makes Americans Americans. Now, Webster published an early short dictionary in 1806, and in this little dictionary and in his grammar textbook, he tried to define what was characteristic of American English. Many of the details that we see in the Great American Dictionary of 1828 are first expressed in this early small dictionary in the grammar books and in the spellers. And central to them is a notion of the American language as made up of words, particular semantic valences, of sounds, a particular phonology, a system of spelling or orthography, and a system of grammar or morphology. When Webster finally published the American Dictionary in 1828, he synthesized more than three decades of his work on language. And he made it clear in the preface to that American Dictionary, and I quote again, "Language is the expression of ideas. And if the people of our country cannot preserve an identity of ideas, they cannot retain an identity of language." But he goes on, and this is where I move on from my previous quotation of this sentiment in my earlier lecture. "No person," Webster writes, "in this country will be satisfied with the English definitions of the word, of the words Congress, Senate, and Assembly, Court, and so on. For," he says, "although these are words used in England, yet they are applied in this country to express ideas which they do not express in that country." Let's pause for a minute over this statement. Congress, Senate, Assembly, and Court, these are, of course, words of the English language. But Webster's argument, it seems to me, is an argument about the way in which a word, in moving across the ocean, also moves across political boundaries. The word Congress or Senate or Assembly and so on means something quite different in America than it means in England. Webster's choice is not arbitrary. He has selected the key words, the core vocabulary of American institutional identity. Think of this phrase now in 1828 going back almost four decades to that earlier grammatical institute. I'll read the quotation again from my previous lecture. This country must, in some future time, be as distinguished by the superiority of her literary improvements as she is by the liberality of her civil and ecclesiastical constitutions. Institute, constitution, Congress, Senate. There is an arc to these terms, a history of American independence written in the semantic shifts of particular, what we might call, high concept words. In the dissertation on the English language, the independent nation phrase that resonated, as I suggested, with Joseph Priestley's phrase about a free nation in the 1770s in his own Rudiments of English Grammar. These are the terms that make the study of language and the practice of lexicography the business of cultural politics. In some sense, we might say that Webster anticipates some of the work of the makers of the Oxford English Dictionary. Or to put it another way, he's an interesting historical bridge between Samuel Johnson's 18th century work on the one hand and the later 19th century English work of the OED on the other. For what Webster does is he creates in the American Dictionary a history of a people. And as we saw in a previous lecture, this was to a large degree the goal of the original makers of the Oxford English Dictionary. Where does history inhere? For Webster, for the makers of the OED, and for Johnson, history inheres at the level of the word. What specifically did Webster do? How is the American dictionary different from a British English dictionary? And what are the differences between the American language as Webster recorded them and the English language of Britain as he knew it? Well, the first thing that Webster did was he advocated a moderate use of spelling reform. Now, we've seen in earlier lectures how spelling reform is a central problem in the history of the English language. Do we spell as we speak, or should we spell according to conventions? One could argue that in this course of lectures, I've given you a kind of history within a history. Now a history not just of speech, but of spelling, as we witnessed the progressive separation of spelling from pronunciation, from spelling as the representation through graphemes, that is, through letters of sound, to spelling as it is rather purely conventional. Now what Webster is interested in doing is conventionalizing spelling in a different way. For most Americans, the obvious difference between British and American forms of writing is in the spelling of certain words. Honor, color, for example. The American spells the word H-N-O-R or C-O-L-O-R. The English person would spell them with the ending O-U-R. H-O-N-O-U-R. C-O-L-O-U-R. This change in spelling is a Websterian innovation. What Webster is interested in, as it were, is paring down the letters of the words, simplifying in order to reflect speech and not encumber the language. Even saying a phrase like encumber the language must recall my earlier quotations from the 16th and 17th century grammarians. Caracts that cumber the tongue, that wonderful phrase from the late 16th century. Music. A word like music in British English of the 18th and 19th century was spelled with a K at the end. And Webster rejects this because he finds the K excrescent. Center, theater, and so on are spelled C-E-N-T-R-E, T-H-E-A-R-T-R-E. These T-R-E spellings become T-E-R spellings for Webster because they seem more accurately to reflect pronunciation. A word like defense, D-E-F, E-N-S-E for America, D-E-F-E-N-C-E for England. This is another example of how Webster is trying to reform American spelling to make it correspond more accurately to a pronunciation, but also to limit the number of excrescent or extra letters in a given word. What are the politics of spelling reform in the dictionary? Webster argues that spelling should, in fact, be more representative of pronunciation than the British. And in effect, he bequeaths to American students the very idea of the silent letter. I've spent a fair amount of time in this course of lectures talking about the history of spelling as in some sense etymological, and that silent letters today, in some cases, were actually pronounced historically. In earlier times, you would have said Knicht instead of Knight. This notion of the letter as silent, and this notion of spelling as no longer reflecting the sounds of speech, this is something which is passed on to us in Webster's dictionary. It's important to stress that Webster is a moderate advocate of spelling reform. That is, he is not interested in creating a kind of phonetic spelling. He's not interested in fully and completely recording speech sounds in all their variety. Rather, he is a simplifier. He is, as it were, paring down American spelling for a new American world. Webster also records in his dictionary what he sees as newer or distinctive American pronunciations. In particular, he gives a pronunciation guide to his dictionary, and in the early spelling manuals and grammar books of the 1780s and 90s, Webster advises the pronunciation of full syllable count in words. Now, I had given you some of these examples in an earlier lecture, necessary versus necessary, secretary versus secretary. It's interesting that if Webster is concerned with minimizing the number of excrescent letters in a word, he's interested, by contrast, in maximizing the pronunciation of syllables. That is, every syllable should be pronounced. Every syllable should have weight. Webster records, and in so doing, in describing, he prescribes a particular American pronunciation. Certain spelling forms, certain pronunciation forms, these are, to a large degree, Webster's bequeathal to American speech and writing. Webster is also, in some sense, an American version of Samuel Johnson. Like Samuel Johnson, his remarks on language change and linguistic diversity draw on naturalistic, organic metaphors for growth. But here, he offers us a particularly American twist on it. And let me read you a passage from Webster on language change. He says, and I quote, "Americans had not only a right to adapt new words, but were obliged to modify the language to suit the novelty of the circumstances, geographical and political, in which they were placed. It is quite impossible to stop the progress of language. It is like the course of the Mississippi, the motion of which at times is scarcely perceptible. Yet even then, it possesses a momentum quite irresistible. Words and expressions will be forced into use in spite of all the exertions of all the writers of the world. Americans have a right. What are our rights? America is a nation founded on rights, on the Declaration of Independence, on the Constitution, on the Bill of Rights. What is our Bill of Rights? Webster writes a linguistic Bill of Rights here, and our right is to adopt new words. Furthermore, we have an obligation to modify the language to suit what he calls the novelty of the circumstances of living in this country. The most defining feature of America for early as much as for contemporary Americans is that unique and distinctive river, the Great Mississippi, which so influences the American literary and linguistic imagination from Webster even to T.S. Eliot, who in one of the four quartets can talk about the river as a brown god. This image, this memory of Eliot recalling now the Mississippi, the banks of the Mississippi, and the river that flowed through the St. Louis of his childhood. So, for Webster, the Mississippi is the single characteristically defining feature of the American landscape, and therefore, it must become the node of metaphor, the place of locating an image for language. For Johnson, if you'll remember, it was the landscape, the trees reflected in the water. It was the human life as men grow old and die. It was the image of embalming. But now, for Webster, it is the Mississippi itself, the motion of which is at times scarcely perceptible. The Mississippi River becomes, in some sense, a metaphor for language itself, just as we will see in Twain, the Mississippi River becomes a metaphor for life and human experience. What is the influence of Webster? As I've suggested just a few minutes ago, Webster's influence lies in regularizing American pronunciation, American spelling, and certain features of the American vocabulary. But his books were phenomenally influential on the education of American children. One can detail many ways in which young Americans learned to read, but for me, perhaps the most poignant and the most powerful of such stories is one told by Frederick Douglass, the ex-slave who would become one of the leading thinkers of America in the mid-19th century, one of the key African-American writers of our culture and our heritage. Frederick Douglass, in a series of autobiographical writings culminating in his final life of Frederick Douglass, Douglass is able to describe how he learned to read. And I want to pause over some of these descriptions because they are exquisitely beautiful and powerful. In a later lecture, I will be talking about Douglass in some detail. Now, I offer just a hint of his phraseology. For a slave, of course, learning to read and write was a punishable activity. And Douglass says, "During the time I was learning to read and write, my copybook was the board fence, brick wall, and pavement. My pen and ink was a lump of chalk. With these, I learned mainly how to write. I then commenced and continued copying the italics in Webster's spelling book until I could make them all without looking on the book. By this time, my little master Thomas had gone to school and had learned how to write and had written over a number of copybooks. These had been brought home and shown to some of our near neighbors and then laid aside. My mistress used to go to class meeting at the Wilkes Street Meeting House every Monday afternoon and leave me to take care of the house. When I left thus, I used to spend my time in writing in the spaces left in Master Thomas's copybook, copying what he had written, writing in the spaces. American literature, American language is written in the spaces." This seems to me a beautiful evocation of a way of understanding the impact of Webster on Frederick Douglass. The way in which, to some degree, the spelling book becomes not just the place where you learn to spell, but the place where spelling is the mark of identity. Writing in the spaces. Webster is, in effect, writing also in the spaces. In a later chapter where Douglass will retell the story, he says, "I used to carry almost constantly a copy of Webster's spelling book in my pocket. And when sent of errands or when playtime was allowed me, I would step with my young friends aside and take a lesson in spelling." Now, I think what's beautiful about this is that Douglass is carrying Webster's spelling book with him, almost not just as a grammar, but I would argue as a Bible. Webster becomes not just the American Johnson, becomes a Bible of good usage. As we will see in a later lecture, Douglass's language is continually infused with the language of the Bible, and as I will suggest also, with the language of Shakespeare. But here, Webster's spelling book becomes the constant companion, the copy of the text. When we look at Douglass, we're looking at the transformation or the reflection of an inheritance of Webster, of attitudes towards the American language. What are some other 19th century views of American language, and how can they help us bridge, as it were, Webster on the one hand and Mencken on the other as the bookends or the two poles of American linguistic scholarship? In 1816, a contemporary of Webster's named John Pickering published what he called a Dictionary of Americanisms, and this was considered by Webster an attack on his position, as the Americanisms here are like Witherspoon's Americanisms, individual locutions, rather than building blocks of an American social and linguistic consciousness. In 1848, John Bartlett published another book of Americanisms, Only here, it's not so much about vocabulary as it is about regional dialect. And what's emerging in the mid-19th century is the recognition that for all the apparent uniformity of American speech, America is a nation of regions. And similarly, the American language is made up of regional dialects. What constitutes an Americanism in the mid-19th century is very often not just an Americanism, but more specifically a regionalism, something which distinguishes American speech from an inherited norm or standard. James Russell Lowell, in New England, in 1866, published the second series of his Bigelow Papers. And here, Lowell argues, in an important and distinctive way, that many of the things that we think of as characteristic of American speech are in fact holdovers of earlier English or earlier British speech. Now, I've given some examples of these in the survival of certain regionalisms, in the survival of certain forms or verbs, and in the survival of certain pronunciations. Lowell recognizes this as well, and the impact of his work is to give, in effect, a kind of larger history to the American language. Perhaps the most important and influential writer on the American language of this period of 19th and early 20th century America is the journalist and lexicographer and social critic H.L. Mencken. Mencken's American Language was originally published in 1919. It went through many editions after that, many revisions and expansions, and there were many supplements published to it. Mencken's work is of great influence because he defines and codifies some of the key issues in American speech and usage. But also, Mencken is writing as much a history of the American people as he is writing a history of the American language. And it's going to be of interest to us to see how, in writing about grammar and use, he also writes about national identity. Mencken is primarily concerned with tracing what he sees as the history and variety of American English. But he's also interested in distinguishing American English from other forms of the language. Broadly speaking, Mencken distinguishes three issues, that make American English unique. And they are as follows. First, what he calls its general uniformity throughout the country. And by this, Mencken means that even though Americans have regional dialects and regional variants, for the most part, these dialects are mutually comprehensible. There is not the great variety of dialect that we have in England, a phenomenon noted, as we saw, a century and a half earlier by Witherspoon. Second, Mencken says, a chief feature of American English is its impatient disregard for grammatical, syntactical, and phonological rule and precedent. Now, Mencken is not saying that Americans speak ungrammatically, as earlier visitors to America did, nor is he saying that Americans are in some sense illiterate or disregarding of rules in general. Rather, I think that what he's saying, and I think this dovetails with some things that Mencken will say a little further on in his work, is that Americans are a people who are impatient of the prescriptions of rule and precedent. That American speech is speech of the moment. That Americans speak clearly and grammatically, but they do not necessarily speak according to the learned or imposed rules or precedents of others, and in particular of the British. Third, the key factor that he notes of American English is what he says, and I quote, is its large capacity, distinctly greater than that of the English of present-day England, for taking new words and phrases from outside sources and for manufacturing them of its own materials. Now, let's look in detail at this kind of phrasing. Americans' large capacity reminds us of Whitman, who sings of multitudes, who speaks of America as large, capacious, voracious, and omnivorous, greater than that of the English of present-day English, for taking in things and manufacturing new words of its own materials. Mencken originally writing in 1919, just at the close of the First World War, when American manufacturing is clearly a decisive factor in military development. The idea that what makes America, America, is that it is a country of manufacturing. It's this idiom and phrasing which I think clearly shapes Mencken's notion of American English as reflecting American people. Americans are Americans. That's general uniformity. Americans are people not bounded by inherited rules or precedents, but they follow their own. That's the second part, the impatient disregard. And then, in its vast capacity for manufacturing new things out of raw materials, Americans distinguish themselves as makers to the world. I want to read on. In his chapter called The Materials of Inquiry and the Hallmarks of American, Mencken goes on to talk about the way in which America's vocabulary is large and capacious. And he says, but more important than the sheer inventions, if only because more numerous, are the extensions of the vocabulary by the devices of rhetoric. The American, from the beginning, has been the most ardent of recorded rhetoricians. Let me read on, since it gets even better. His politics bristles with pungent epithets. His whole history has been bedizened with tall talk. His fundamental institutions rest far more upon brilliant phrases than upon logical ideas. A brilliant case here in Mencken of miming, of imitating, of reflecting the very subject matter of his speech. What makes America, America, and Americans, Americans? They are inventive. Sheer inventions. This is a country that manufactures, that invents. Vocabulary is an American invention, much as the automobile or the airplane is an American invention. American rhetoric. In a subsequent lecture, I'm going to talk about American rhetoric, the language of politics and of privacy from Jefferson to Lincoln, the way in which the American self is a rhetorical self. The rhetoric of Mencken is the rhetoric of America right now. His politics bristles with pungent epithets. Just feel the texture of that phrase. Remember the word bristle, which I talked about in the OED, the way in which the semantic history of bristle moves from the physical to the emotive. Now Mencken is restoring the very physical quality of bristling, pungent epithets, as if it were now the American tongue, not just the American language, as the organ of expression, bristling with pungent epithets, with spices, with flavors of the world. His whole history has been bedizened with tall talk. Tall talk takes us back to tales, tales of Paul Bunyan, tales of adventure, tales of politicians, tales of presidents. Tall talk, a beautiful alliterative phrase here that makes it stick in the mind, that is as much a mnemonic as any piece of Old English from the age of Cadman. His fundamental institutions rest far more upon brilliant phrases than upon logical ideas. His fundamental institutions. The institutions of American men and of American women are institutions, Mencken would argue, that rest less on ideas than on phrases. Go back now to Webster, to a grammatical institute of the English language, and you can see us come full circle in American history and American history of the language. If, as I suggested, Webster is giving us a grammatical institute as a story of American institutions, Mencken is turning it on its head. Institutions are not acts or beliefs, but institutions are phrases themselves. They are not arguments, but rhetoric. They are not substance, but superficiality. But that really cannot be true. American rhetoric is shot through with the power and the pain and the poignancy of experience. The little snippet that I read of Frederick Douglass gives us a sense of an American rhetoric built up out of the spelling book of Webster. And for Mencken himself, giving us an example of beautiful, dazzling, and poignant phrasing here, of pungent words and tall talk, we can see American rhetoric inflected by the American language. Now, at the beginning of the 20th century, we see a lens held up to the 18th and the 19th. Through that lens, as I will show in subsequent lectures, the American self and the American institutions of self and society reveal themselves to be linguistic and rhetorical in nature. The history of the American language is now the history of the American people and the history of the American self, a history of tall talk. Thank you.